they've put so much liquidity in here. They're running a budget right now that is, as you know, it's probably 6-7% of GDP and you're not in a recession. Normally that's something you would do in a recession. So there's a chance that they overcooked the goose and we have this, you know, surprise inflation bounce, which we're starting to see. That's why people are moving out of bonds and into harder asset plays. Like you just look at Alcoa, you know, a lot of the aluminum names, look at copper, you look at oil and gas, you look at gold and silver. These groups have taken in about $1 trillion of assets in the last, you know, couple of months. And so there's definitely some type of fear in the market of a runaway type inflation run with higher bond yields that creates some type of financial event. That's definitely a creeping fear that's kind of coming into the market.
On this episode of What the Finance Podcast, I have the pleasure of welcoming on Larry McDonald. So Larry is the founder of the Bear Trap Report and author of the recently released book, How to Listen When Markets Speak. So Larry, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks for having us. It's been a busy couple of weeks, so it's nice to settle down a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, we were talking before the book's released a few weeks ago, and I can imagine you've been very busy, and I'm sure the volatility in markets has kept you busy as well. But my first question, you know, what was your influence for writing the book?
So I tell you, we wrote the first book, and was published in 12 languages. It was a New York Times bestseller. And what I quickly learned is you make much more money on the speaking tour than you do writing the book. But the most rewarding thing is the people that you meet. And so picture Lehman went down in 2008. We went on the speaking tour. We did about 140 speeches in 16 countries. And we met a lot of talented hedge funds, mutual fund, pension fund managers, really incredible basket of friends and talent. And we created this Bloomberg chat behind us with a lot of these PMs that are around the world. You know, they're in different countries. And so what I want to do with the second book is kind of bring the reader, younger people, audience around the world that's reading the book. We want to give them kind of a lens on a buy-side conversation. So what are the professionals doing? Like what, how can someone reading this book get rewarded by learning from veteran investors all around the world? And so the first book kind of led to this book, and it's kind of like taking information, crowdsourcing it, building up ideas, and then giving back. This book, When Markets Speak, is all about democratizing information.
Yeah, and it's an important thing to do. So if you go to the markets now, because as you said, there's lots of amazing people throughout the book who talk about their thoughts about what's happening and maybe a secular shift that we're seeing. But what are your current views on, I guess, macroeconomics that we've seen over the past few years and I guess what we could see in 2024 and beyond?
Well, you know, the Lehman crisis was a $4 trillion fiscal and monetary response. So, and that was a big election year, right? So that was a major election. It was McCain versus Obama. Obama was a good candidate. McCain was an older candidate. But at the end of the day, the 2008 financial crisis really helped Obama. And the Biden team knows that. The Biden team knows that Biden's a weaker candidate relative to Obama. But they also know that a financial crisis will doom, you know, his reelection. And so the response to COVID plus the banking crisis of 2023, which was at least four banks, New York Community Bank, Signature, Silicon Valley Bank. So that fiscal and monetary response to this crisis, this regime crisis, was about $16 trillion. And so what they've done is they've, with the giant fiscal and monetary, they've prevented kind of a near-term recession, but they've for sure almost certainly guaranteed a much more sustained inflation regime. And if you go into a sustained inflation regime where inflation normalizes at say 3-4% versus the previous decade was 1-2, then you need a whole new portfolio, you need a whole new investment outlook. And we kind of want to bring the reader in this book behind the scenes and like, what are the professionals really thinking about and what are they doing to get out ahead of this new trend?
Yeah, okay, really interesting. And has this been exclusively, I guess, the monetary and fiscal spending that's influenced this? Because I guess a lot, you know, maybe if you're works for the Biden administration, you'd say this is inflation that's global. This isn't just for the US. This is something that's affected everyone. So I guess why is that the case?
Well, that's true to some extent. I mean, we have a multipolar world now. One of the points of the book is that there's a scene in the book where I sit down with André Esteves, famous billionaire investor in Brazil, and he talks about a multipolar world versus a unipolar world. And a multipolar world is a world where your sea lanes aren't as secure, your cost to move products around the world is a lot higher, oil and gas prices are higher because of global conflicts. And so in that multipolar world, you have much more of a global conflict atmosphere. Like I said, supply chains that are more disrupted. And so in wartime, one thing that Neil Ferguson, when I worked with Neil Ferguson, he helped me with the book to some extent. And he said several times, said, Larry, you know, wars and global conflicts create sustained inflation. And so this book is really about, okay, you know, a multipolar world, you need a whole new investment portfolio. So it's not just what's happening in the United States. It's what's happening around the world. It's kind of like a 1968 to 1980 regime, which had a lot more, you know, the Vietnam War, and a lot more of a global conflict regime. You had a crisis in the Middle East, right? Similar now with, you know, oil crisis with the OPEC in the 70s. And so it's a very similar setup. So it's creating spectacular opportunities for investors watching us right now.
Okay. So what you're saying is that there's lots of different factors that are going into, I guess, this this high inflation that we could be experiencing. There's all the countries spending lots of money, as well as the global geopolitical risk increasing.
Yes, but the U.S., because the fiscal monetary response is $16 trillion to the COVID crisis and to the banking crisis, and the Lehman fiscal and monetary response was about $4 trillion, that is one of the large anchors toward inflation. Like, in other words, I shouldn't say anchor, but something that pushes inflation forward, among other things that are happening in the world, for sure.
Okay. No, that definitely makes sense. So you're seeing it going back to sort of what we saw in the 60s and 70s. So you think that, sorry if I'm putting words in your mouth, but you know, the last 40 years has been very beneficial for long duration, both bonds and assets. And you think that we could see a switch sort of going back to the 60s, where, you know, I'm pretty sure equity markets didn't do very well, and very high inflation and lots of other factors that influence the markets.
Yes. And then there's, okay, so let's go back to, once again, to the Lehman crisis and the post-Lehman world. The austerity that came out of the United States. So the Republicans took the House in, say, 2010. They took the Senate in 2014. They forced a lot of austerity onto the Obama presidency. And that created a lot of disinflationary forces. At the same time, we had a crisis in Greece that created a ton of austerity there, and we had the Brexit. So we had an austerity-filled decade that kind of created a much more sustained disinflationary regime. Now, if you go around the Hill, you know, we spend a lot of times on the Hill with our partners. We bring clients, hedge fund clients around the Hill. There's just absolutely zero motivation for austerity across any party, either party. And so, and same thing in pretty much Europe, if you look at where the budgets are lining up in Italy and France, everybody's kind of abandoned the austerity regime. So you're in a sovereign build-out of debt, which that, once again, that's going to contribute to higher bond yields, higher inflation. And so, therefore, we think that there's literally, you know, $5 or $6 trillion that's in the wrong place. In other words, everybody's long a 2010 to 2020 portfolio. The entire, there's $35 trillion, Anthony, that's tied to passive investments in the S&P 500, the NASDAQ. There's $21 trillion in the NASDAQ 100. So everybody's essentially long that disinflation, that deflationary playbook that was so strong for 20 years and was capped off in that post-Lehman world. And now, as you head toward a different regime of inflation and sustained bond yields and holding, you need an entirely different portfolio that's typically led by hard assets, value companies, emerging markets, but value stocks, not long duration. Just look in the last couple of weeks, your long duration portfolios, like in your software, cloud computing, the CLOU ETF, is dramatically underperforming the cash cows ETF. And so there's a lot of clues that are starting to come at us. We talk about those clues in our book, When Markets Speak.
Okay. And is this all linked to, I guess, the fact that we saw decreasing and low, and you know, very low interest rates, which meant that people were sort of pushing further to try and find yields. And that's why, you know, they push further on the risk perspective. Is that sort of what we saw? And now it's almost flipped on its head because of the inflationary factors?
Yeah, that's the evil thing about quantitative easing, is that when you suppress the cost of capital for longer and longer periods of time, you're distorting the cost of capital. You create, you incentivize really horrible decisions each year that goes on. After 1 year, it's not a big deal. But at 10 years of really distorting the cost of capital, if you look at the banking system in the United States, we talk about this in the book, like the amount of money that's in commercial real estate, that's in mortgage-backed securities that are, you know, we're talking about 1%, 2%, 3% securities, really mispriced capital because the Fed suppressed capital for so long. So all those banks that were selling, lending money at 1%, 2%, 3% on mortgages, on huge office complexes, all of those securities are mispriced. And to give you an example, Apple issued a bond in, say, 2020, 21. They issued billions of dollars of bonds. But one of the bonds they issued was a long duration bond, and which means long maturity. And that bond traded within the last couple of months. You know, this bond's backed by Apple, you know, and the bond traded in the 50s, right? Low 60s, high 50s. That tells you, like, when interest rates go up, bond prices go down. And so the Fed and central banks around the world, because of suppressing that cost of capital for so long, they've really created a giant hole on a lot of bank balance sheets. It's like this emerging financial crisis that came at us last year. It's going to come at us this year again, where the banks are just holding on to a lot of really bad assets.
Yeah, and it has been interesting, I guess. Sorry, maybe before I go on to that point, one thing that I have been really interested in, and something that I haven't really heard many other people say, is just, you talk about austerity in the US, and it's something that you hear, you know, it's very common that you hear that occurred in you know, the UK and Europe and all throughout, you know, this continent, but it's not something that you normally hear that occurred in the US, but it does make a lot of sense to maybe why we experience austerity. Is that sort of a similar trend? Or am I maybe just not listening to the right people?
Yeah, we're in a period where politicians just don't care about austerity anymore. And well, you just look at the Liz Truss moment, right, in the UK. And that's basically an appetizer that's coming to the US, where, you know, the politicians want to do tax cuts, and the bond market just body slammed the politicians in the UK. And that's what's starting to happen now. So yeah, we're in a revolution between the bond vigilantes, or bond holders and bond buyers are just revolting against the extreme hubris and ignorance that's coming out of, say, Washington, a lot of governments around the world that are recklessly spending money. And they just, once again, remember just kind of what you just said. They've had 20 years of, they've been enabled by central banks. They've been conditioned to spend money in an extremely irresponsible fashion. So all of their body behaviors, everything that they're about, everything that they've done over the last 15, 20 years as a politician, all of that behavior has been distorted by central banks distorting the cost of capital. And now we're moving into a real world where it's the cost of capital is more market driven. And that's why you're seeing these kind of face-offs, these kind of battles between bond markets and politicians.
Yeah, and you could say that's not just for politicians. It's also investors. It's also, you know, most people in, you know, who are just entering their careers or have sort of been in a career for 15 years. It's all they've experienced. So I guess that they're a lot of the times people who are shaping the direction and where society is going. And then I guess why have we not seen a crash yet, do you believe? Because it does seem as if, you know, things have been doing pretty well despite interest rates being at, you know, the highest they've been for 15 years, especially in the markets, at least until the last few days. So why do you think it's held out so well?
Well, last year we had a crash. Like, we had the banks dropped. At one point, Bank of America was down 50%, Citibank. The super regional banks were all down 40, 50. But once again, the Fed and Treasury threw a ton of liquidity at this. Remember, the Treasury and the Fed are terrified of the financial crisis again helping Trump. You know, they despise Trump. This is a group of people, you know, there's a group of people in Washington that impeached Trump twice, right? And they've sued him. You know, there's four lawsuits. They will do anything in their power to keep this guy out of office. And a lot of people don't like him. And so that's the fact. And so they've done, you know, we had this financial crisis last year. They expanded the Fed balance sheet. They pumped a ton of liquidity into the market. And they're just trying to, and that's creating a sustained inflation bounce. Their pawns in the media are doing what we call real-time gaslighting the last like 5 months on inflation. Like, even as inflation's bouncing, their pawns in an election year are just like, you know, downplaying it because they just want to get through the election. They want to kick Trump's butt. And they want another 4 years, and they're willing to deal with the inflationary replications, you know, impact after the election. But in the meantime, they're doing whatever they can to prevent, you know, that type of crash or that type of problem.
Okay, so that's you know, as you said, talking down inflation. That's providing as much fiscal stimulus as, you know, basically unlimited fiscal stimulus. It's sort of monetary policy. They're doing everything they can to prevent this crash.
Yes, but you still could listen. Remember, they're not like perfect. They're playing with a serpent. They're playing with a beast. And so they've put so much liquidity in here. They're running a budget right now that is, as you know, it's probably 6-7% of GDP and you're not in a recession. Normally that's something you would do in a recession. So there's a chance that they overcooked the goose. And we have this, you know, surprise inflation bounce, which we're starting to see. That's why people are moving out of bonds and into harder asset plays. Like, you just look at Alcoa, you know, a lot of the aluminum names, look at copper, you look at oil and gas, you look at gold and silver. These groups have taken in about $1 trillion of assets in the last, you know, couple of months. And so there's definitely some type of fear in the market of a runaway type inflation run with higher bond yields that creates some type of financial event. That's definitely a creeping fear that's kind of coming into the market.
Hey everyone, sorry for interrupting. I just wanted to extend a massive thank you to you for listening and tuning in and for your support over these 3 years. So we've had you know, hundreds of guests that we've welcomed on the podcast. We've had millions of views. We've hundreds of thousands of different people listening in. So I just wanted to thank you. You know, I started this as a student. I'm now currently working. And I've always done this on the side just because I have a passion for it and I've enjoyed it. And probably similar to yourself, you listen to all these, you know, different YouTube channels and podcasts of people listening to different guests. That's how I started. And I just wanted to sort of take the plunge and be able to have the opportunity to speak to these people. And you've made that happen. So thank you very much. Just myself, don't make any money from this. And it's really a passion project. So thanks for supporting that passion of mine. If you wanted to support the channel, all I ask is if you could like, subscribe, or even comment, you know, positive or negative feedback. I'm always willing to take constructive criticism. I'd really appreciate that. But otherwise, thanks so much. If you can believe it, only 14% of our listeners actually subscribe to the podcast. So yeah, if you can, great. If not, no problem at all. Thanks for listening. And yep, let's get back to the show. Okay, so you're seeing institutional investors moving more into these real asset type, you know, commodity plays. Do you see something similar to 2008, 2009, where these commodity prices went through the roof and then sort of helped to influence a recession? Or do you think that would take a while?
No, they're definitely going to influence a recession. Like the bottom 60% of Americans are in extreme pain. If you're trying to refinance a car or a house, you're in a lot of pain. So that, but the top 20% of Americans just got a huge pay raise. If you have money in a money market fund, say $10 million, you're making $80,000 a year two years ago. You're now making $500,000 a year just on cash. And so that's what's creating this. Like, you've got one part of the economy that's in a pretty nasty recession that's out there. But the other side is in a boom, and it's, you know, that kind of fight is off, and both sides are kind of offsetting each other and preventing kind of a bigger problem. But yeah, so if you have a blow off top in inflation that gets worse and it starts to hurt, say, instead of like that 20% is doing fine, and then that, you know, bottom 60%, if the pain of inflation, you know, grows over the next couple of months, then that inflation and higher rates could really start to impact, you know, more people, and then that's where it tips you into a real recession.
Okay, makes sense. And do you see this being, I guess, a longer term trend, or do you think that once we potentially experience this recession, things will go back the way that they were pre-COVID?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, so in talking to our institutional clients around the world, if we go into recession, the Fed funds rate is up above 5%. So they can cut rates. That gets you a weaker dollar. At some point, to get out of a $35 trillion debt hole, and that's where the U.S. is now, the only way to get out of that is two ways: a default through what we call a debt jubilee, which we go through the Latin. In the book, we go through, you know, last like thousands of years of civilizations, many civilizations have created debt jubilees where they just walk away from the debt and default. And Argentina is a modern day example of that, right? They've done several times. So the other way to get out of a $35 trillion debt hole is to inflate your way out through what we call financial repression. So if you can keep interest rates below the rate of inflation, so in other words, say we go in recession, and then they suppress rates through QE, quantitative easing, and inflation is sustained at a higher level. If you keep interest rates below inflation, interest rates here, inflation here, you can start to, you know, monetize that debt. And that's what they really want behind the scenes. They know they have a debt problem, and they know the only way out of it is to monetize. And I think that's the secret plan behind the scenes.
Okay. Are there any examples of that having occurred successfully in the past? I can't think of too many.
Well, the financial repression happened, say, in after World War II, where, you know, interest rates were low and then inflation because of the war. So you've had periods of financial repression. And then you have also, you know, at the end of the day, what we talk about in the book, there are cycles with democracies. And, you know, Tocqueville and Tytler have talked about democracies can only last, and this is like from the 1700s, 1800s, a democracy can only last until the voters realize they can essentially control and vote themselves generous gifts from the public treasury. And so if you go back in history, the cycles of democracy typically start off with, like, you know, what we call bondage, or saying right, 1776, the U.S. was kind of like in bondage because the U.S. was in a revolution with the UK, right? And so then you go into patriotism, entrepreneurship, abundance. And so you go through this growth phase, and then you go back toward dependence, apathy, and then back to bondage. And so that's the cycle of many democracies. Many democracies, looking back, they really don't last more than 250 years, because typically the voters you know, realize that they can just keep voting themselves and raid the public treasury, build up the deficits. And these cycles just keep repeating. And I think the U.S. is probably somewhere in that apathy dependent stage. And if you just look at Venezuela, like I said, Argentina, there's a lot of democracies that end up back into that bondage stage where you're in a back toward a dictatorship.
Okay. So do you see this? I'm guessing that would be quite bad for the US dollar and sort of the US hegemony across the world, but it doesn't seem like, you know, it's always possible, but it's not looking like that's on the horizon.
Well, these are 250 year cycles, right?
Yeah.
So it takes a long time to debase the world's reserve currency, but the playbook for debasing the currency is out there through the debt, through sanctions, abuse. Like the way they use sanctions in Washington is something that we talk about this in the book When Markets Speak. But you know, the sanctions, the taking property away from countries. I mean, these are things that it's hubris in the sense that these are weapons that you should use once every 10 years. We're using them almost every year. And so you're incentivizing global players to move away from the dollar. And you can see, just look at China's hold, you know, ownership of treasuries. It's on the same path as Russia. You know, Russia, Putin was planning this invasion for like a decade because his holdings of treasuries went from like 200 billion to almost zero, and his holdings of gold, you know, exploded in those years before the Ukraine invasion. And so it's very ominous that countries around the world that are exposed to potential sanctions, exposed to potential conflicts, countries like China are holding and owning less and less and less and less treasuries. And so, you know, now the team in Washington needs a new buyer. We're going to have to either, that's where you get into financial repression. You're going to have to force pension funds. You're going to have to force investors to own more treasuries, or you're going to have to buy the treasuries yourself at the Fed and suppress interest rates.
Yeah, and I guess it means they have less control over what's happening globally. They have to, if they want to actually stop someone from doing something, they'd have to, you know, obviously sanctions are an option, or actually go to war, which is not what we want. But yeah, there's less control over, I guess, the global world.
Yeah, sanctions, if you look at the way Republicans and Democratic administrations the last decade have used sanctions, they are just like over the top abuse. And so if you're an emerging market country, you've just seen this aggressive use of sanctions. You've seen a confiscation of assets and capital. You're going to start diversifying into things like gold, silver, platinum, Bitcoin, other types of assets. And I think that's what we're beginning to see.
Yep. So where do you see, you know, we've talked about gold and sort of commodities and energy. Are you seeing that they're going to be, I guess, the main countries that produce our companies that produce are going to be the main winners in the going forward during this financial repression and other potential factors?
Well, we've taken 5 million jobs out of the United States. 5 million. We've decimated the Rust Belt. America has been completely decimated. Life expectancy of males above like 40 in manufacturing states is collapsed. It's coming down at an alarming rate. No one will tell you this, right? But it's a fact. And Goldman Sachs has written about this, and we have a lot of the stats in the book. So we've basically taken those jobs out of the United States. We've shotgunned those jobs around the world, to Bangladesh, India, China. We've raised the standard of living. That's the good news. The good news is the globalists, the Davos crowd, they've accomplished their primary mission. They've raised the standard of living globally. But the idiot savant nature of this is that they are creating an entire new generation of carbon consumers, right? And so if you're in India and you work in the call center, you make 10, 20, 100 times more than your great-grandparents. And so we've got carbon consumption in India, in many parts of Asia, is exploding. And we're creating all these new carbon consumers. At the same time, you've got artificial intelligence that, if you listen to NVIDIA and the pump artists on at the NVIDIA conference calls. They're if you just believe them, we're going to have the amount of terawatt hours that's going to be required to fund these data centers or to support these data centers is going to be up just an extreme amount. We're hearing like 460 terawatt hours annually to maybe 2,000. And this is, you're talking about the size of demand for electricity and power to power these data centers on artificial intelligence. You're talking about the type of usage of Italy, France, and Germany combined just for those data centers in the United States and around the world. And so we have a power grid in the United States that's 2,000 years old. We've got all these new carbon consumers in the world. We've got all these new potential what we call copper consumers that are coming out of artificial intelligence. Yeah, so you want a whole new playbook. You want a playbook that is filled with a portfolio that has companies that have claims on real assets. Whereas right now, people are long portfolios that are paper currency, like paper assets that have claims on a stock, a tech stock, that may have a long duration basket of cash flows. But a lot of these companies don't have assets that can protect a company or an investor against inflation. And so that's where you're going to have this kind of like a massive migration into you know, totally different asset classes.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then something that could be interesting, do you see this giving more power to, I guess, commodity producers such as OPEC? And because you look at the moment, they're, you know, doing pretty well. They're printing lots of cash. They're spending lots of money. Does this just solidify the influence they will have globally?
You know, when you talk to institutional investors around the world, you talk to people that actually know participants in this game. OPEC's just laughing all the way to the bank. We've just spent the last 5 years on this ESG mantra. You know, think about the 2020 election. You think about the last couple of years, like each candidate was promising to get rid of or ban shale exploration. So we've made carbon and kind of like we're basically everybody's focused on the demand on supply. This is where you get into like real idiot savant stuff. So everybody's focused on the supply of oil and gas and basically saying, oh, you can't produce this, and I'm going to regulate you and regulate this, and I'm not going to let you transport that. And meanwhile, nobody's focused on demand. So we're suppressing supply. We've accentuated and basically hit the gas pedal on demand through, like I said, everything that's going on with the global population and everything that's going on with artificial intelligence. So it's nearly certain we have a massive energy crisis sometime in 2025, 26, 27, 28.
Yeah, it's quite interesting though, because I guess the US has never produced more oil or energy, oil or LNG, despite what Biden's trying to say. So I feel like there is a bit of a...
Hold on. Remember, this is what they do. I mean, these are gaslighters now, and both sides. Republicans did this in 2008. They lied through their teeth. Republicans lied through their teeth to get... They basically were suppressing the financial crisis's risk in terms of like they were downplaying them. Democrats, oil production's flat. It's like, okay, we're back up at 13 million barrels a day. Okay, but that's like 5 years later. So the global population from 2014 to today is up 900 million people. Okay, 900 million people. And U.S. oil production, oh, they'll say, oh, U.S. oil production is record levels. Yeah, but it's flat since 2018. So we went from 13 million barrels a day in 2018, 19, 20, somewhere in there, down, way down, and now we're back up, maybe slightly higher. That's a problem, a huge problem with global population and AI and everything around carbon consumption in India, China, Bangladesh, and all kinds throughout Asia.
Yeah, and you know, we probably only got away with it because China were having all their economic struggles, but it looks like their growth is coming back. And if, you know, if they do continue this acceleration, then I think they're going to be demanding a lot more energy, and it's could see the price go a lot further.
Yeah, it's you know, we've basically taken an economy in the United States where the United States used to produce things. We've, in terms of natural resources, the U.S., in terms of like just uranium supply, all kinds of manufacturing capabilities, all types of commodities, rare earth metals. The United States has basically pulled back from the production of these key resources through regulation, through ESG. And now we've placed those national security interests of uranium, that's the uranium needed to basically support the global and U.S. nuclear power plant facilities, is now, if you look at the enrichment of uranium, it's controlled by Russian area type parts of the world. What we call massive jurisdictional risk to uranium. That's why, you know, the people in Washington are starting to scramble now, because they've been asleep at the switch. If you look at all the key rare earth metals that we need to supply our windmills, all the, you know, tons of the key rare earths that we need to supply the Green New Deal, these things are all controlled by the Chinese and the Russians. It's mind blowing. You know, we've just, it's poor planning. It's running, it's letting politicians kind of run things without kind of a long-term plan. And then it's, they meant well on, you know, the carbon side and the whole global, you know, Green New Deal. But when you do that, you're really creating some massive unintended consequences.
Yeah, definitely. So when researching for the book, I guess when writing it, what was something that surprised you the most, I guess, during this process?
I guess, like, you know, thinking about there's a billion people in India that don't have air conditioning. I mean, a billion people in India that don't have air conditioning. And you think of like, okay, we're raising the standard of living in India. And then like the first thing you do as a young man or woman, you make a little bit more money, you're going to air conditioning demand, it's going to dramatically expand carbon consumption. And then the other thing is a lot of these countries in the emerging markets, they can't afford right now to build out the wind and solar. And no matter what they tell you about China, it's a lot of noise. China's coal consumption is exploding. Ever since the Paris Climate Accord, it's an insult to the planet. And it's an insult to everybody that gave us a snow job and a lot of BS around the Paris Climate Accord. It was complete. It was either BS or China just completely has gone off the rails on carbon consumption since. I mean, we're talking about they're using more coal each year than in terms of new coal plants coming online. There's more coal plants coming online in China than there are in the rest of the world. And so this is one of the biggest, I mean, just think of like Apple. They're making all these iPhones in China and now moving over to India. All these, you know, they've got a billion iPhones created by Apple. All they were basically backed by carbon and coal. And nobody cares. And so you're going to have a big backlash against these companies that have been exporting the green guilt, right? They're trying to please the politicians. But it's really like these Western countries are exporting green guilt to China and India and letting them, you know, abuse the planet in the coal and the carbon side. And it makes no sense. It makes for great sound bites. And by saying that we're going to reduce carbon consumption in the United States. But meanwhile, the dirty secret is carbon consumption in India, China, and many parts of the developing world is exploding.
Yeah. A fascinating fact I heard was that, you know, just the Chinese steel manufacturing sector produces more carbon than the UK, Germany and Turkey combined, which are the three largest emitters. And that's just one sector in China. It produces more than those three countries' total emissions. So,
and we see young people that are, you know, attaching themselves to pieces of artwork in museums. It just, the whole thing is just like people have to educate themselves. The problem, like, if you're going to suppress carbon consumption in the UK, that's a rounding error to what's happening in India, China. And it's because we've exported all these jobs, we've raised the standard of living, in the developing world. And those carbon consumers are multiplying at a very, very fast clip.
Yep, agreed. And then the people who are saying, you know, get rid of LNG, even though it could reduce emissions by 20 or 30% versus coal, plus more if you use carbon capture and other factors. It's we definitely live in an interesting world. But Larry, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. My last question is, what is one message that people should take away from our conversation?
Well, just democratize information, give back. You know, I think you can get everything in life that you want if you just help enough other people get what they want. And that's what we've done with this book, is When Markets Speak. It's a global bestseller now. It's number one on Amazon across a lot of different categories. Pick up a copy. It'll change your game in finance. It'll also prepare you for the road ahead.
Perfect. I'll put a description down below for that. And if anyone wanted to find out your other work, where would the best places for that be?
Well, on Twitter, we're at ConvertBond. And we're at the Bear Traps Report is our business, where we provide advice to hedge funds and financial advisors around the world. So it's at thebeartrapsreport.com and at ConvertBond on Twitter.
Perfect. I'll put that in the description below, but thanks again for your time.
Thanks, Anthony.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate the support. If you've got value out of this, I'd really appreciate it if you could like, subscribe, or comment, you know, good or bad feedback. I'm always open to that. But it really helps with the channel. As I said before, only about 14% of people actually subscribe to this channel. So if you were to that, it would really help. It could mean we could continue to grow. If not, thanks for watching and see you on the next show. And you also might like this video right here. All right. Thanks again.